Sorry for the potty mouth.
So, how do we start?
Hi, this is Aga and Łukasz, and this is Catching the Next Wave podcast, where we discuss the future of design.
And much more. We're talking with Mel today, and Mel says on her webpage, which is a bit outdated, so we'll get the rest of it from her, that she had varied jobs. She was an ethnomusicologist, cook, IT project manager, agile coach, and the main focus has been the strengthening of teamwork and facilitating communication. Dedicated agilist, worked with a range of companies in different countries and for different industries. Along the way, she has filled her agile kit with a range of tools and experiences that she taps into wherever she goes. Yeah, I can confirm that. Currently, she is coaching a distributed team from Barcelona and Hamburg at Xing. No.
Yeah, it's out of date. Currently, I'm an agile coach at Alpha Health.
Alpha Health.
Yeah.
All right. But before we get there, I have to ask about who ethnomusicologist is.
Ethnomusicology? Well, first of all, I don't have a background at all in engineering or computer science or anything like that. I went to university on a music scholarship. So I was doing music performance. I was playing viola in the orchestra. And after my first year, I got out of the performance track because I didn't have the dedication to just practice hours and hours a day at it. And then I went into musicology and history. You know, I got my degree. I moved to New York City. And one of my first jobs was producing concerts around the city of music from around the world.
Mm. Wow.
Indian music or Pakistani music or African music. Basically, music from around the world. The company I was working for was called the World Music Institute. And so that's how I got into world music. And I decided after a couple of years working for them that I actually wanted to get a degree in world music, which is what ethnomusicology is. It's basically the anthropology of music. And it's anything that's not Western classical music falls under the umbrella of ethnomusicology. So even you can have ethnomusicologists who write about Western popular music, that would still be ethnomusicology, not musicology. So I was doing that. And actually, that was my foray into the land of interactive, because what happened was I got a grant to do a performance in Africa in the 90s. I'm dating myself. In the early 1994, I went to West Africa and I was working on this intercultural performance in Ghana with some drummers and dancers. And then when I got back to New York, I had to report to the foundation that gave me the money, how I spent the money. The traditional way you do it is just write a long report, you know, a Word document about what you did and how you did it and how where the money went. And I decided instead to do a website about it. That was like, you know, when the internet was just starting to burst on the scene. And so, you know, I had the video and the music clips, taught myself HTML, and I was like, I really fell in love with it and thought, okay, I want to keep doing this. Back then it was really easy actually to just do it because there weren't any kind of certifications or anything. People were just winging it and self-inventing themselves. And so I managed to get a job at an interactive agency as a project manager, just based on what I knew and how I work with people. And that's kind of how I went off on this path. I was working for an interactive agency the second half of the 90s. Doing giant websites for Citibank and Delta Airlines and Philips Electronic, that kind of thing. But it was all very traditional project management. And then life happened and I fell in love with a Scottish person. We were living in New York at the time. And because of the fact that there was no gay marriage in the US, she couldn't stay with me in New York. So we decided to pack up and move to Scotland. I quit my job. I sold the house. We moved all the animals and ourselves over to Scotland. And I decided that at that point to just take a break and pursue a completely different path, which I'm also very much in love with, which is cooking and food. And so I went to culinary school, learned how to cook, and started working in hotel restaurants at the very bottom of the brigade, person doing all the messy stuff. And gradually, and then we moved around, we were moving around in Scotland, and I ended up working for a catering company that just did paellas, and was also working in a cafe doing lunches and stuff like that. And it was wonderful work. Like, I loved it. Time disappeared for me. It was like the days would disappear. I would just be in that zone state where you had to like just get shit done and work really hard. And it was hard work. It was hard physical work for me, but I loved it. But the money wasn't great. So I decided to go back to project management and found this startup in Glasgow, Scotland. I started out there as a project manager again. And then my boss at the time said, I've heard about this agile thing, Mel. We find out about it. Maybe we can do it. So it was basically on his request that I started reading about Scrum, went and did a two-day course with Mike Cohn and Ken Schwaber, actually. I was really lucky to have them as instructors. Took the pill and never turned back to project management. And here I am in Spain.
That's
now.
That's an impressive story. So let's hook into this agile stuff, because there are different ways, I guess, to think what this agile thing is. I have been through phases, and I think at this moment I'm quite convinced that it's actually about people, nothing more.
I agree and I don't agree. There's kind of the way into agile, which is about the value stream, how you build things, and this idea of empirical process control, not only on the product, but how you build the product, right? So there's that kind of part of agile. For sure, the team element is fundamental. And this is what I've done. I've based pretty much my whole career on the team aspect of it. And then there's the whole other part, which is kind of the technical part, which, you know, I know about it. I can't teach it because I don't do it. That's everything from test-driven development to DevOps and all of that, like how you do it. You know, Lissa Atkins, what's it called? The Institute of Agile Coaching or Agile Coaching Institute or something like that. She did a really interesting thing where she drew that map. What does it mean to be an agile coach? And you have to have knowledge in all of these areas, all these different components of it. But you can specialize, like I've specialized in kind of the team part of it and the communication part. But really, you need to know about the other stuff as well, the whole business part of it, the technical part of it, and then, yeah, the people part of it. Of course, without people, you wouldn't even have this thing. So yes, I agree with you that it's kind of the base. You need to have people who are able to work together. And that's not agile anymore. That's just human beings.
You said that people means teams. But I also see a lot of people trying to find their way as individuals, in a sense that if you have someone who is responsible, for example, for the direction of the product or for the project or company, whatever, so still changing into this quote-unquote new way of thinking, that requires changes on a more personal level. So it doesn't have to be team-related, but it somehow has to do with embracing new ways and maybe some courage and maybe trying new things.
Even at that kind of leader level, that mindset shift needs to be towards teams. You need to be able to draw on the power of a team. to be the most effective. That's why everyone's like anti-command and control. And so if you have this kind of sole leader at the top orchestrating everything and making all decisions, then you're not really going to have the optimal results, right? So it still is about team. I guess that's a really interesting question. Can you be agile without being in a team?
I recently read a post from Seth Godin where he was talking about the difference between running a hierarchical organization versus running a studio. What he wrote was that in the hierarchical structure, you've got one person who tells you what to do, so the command and control, like you mentioned. In a studio setup, it's more about collaboration, about everybody chipping into the idea and bringing the idea together. When I was listening to both of you talking about it, I was thinking that perhaps this is a good metaphor for what you're talking about, that agile is turning an organization that's predominantly hierarchical into a setup which is more like a bunch of studios that collaborate together. So you've got the collaboration within the studio or a part of the studio, within the project in the studio itself, and then between the studios. Mm-hmm. If you imagine the company being a network of studios that work with each other and contract each other, suddenly this is very similar to what Agile is.
Can I throw another complication into this?
Sure.
Because I have a suspicion, I would like to bounce it from both of you, that actually depends on a problem at hand. I have never visited a Toyota factory, but they are kind of poster child of agility as in Lean. And when I was thinking about this, when you mentioned this, Aga, then I thought, if I have a job or a problem that is repeatable, that I should automate because I want to have the same result over and over again, it's nothing wrong in structure.
Of course.
I don't want to say hierarchy. I'm saying structure, hierarchy is just one of them. And it also doesn't have to mean that the decisions are made from the top to the bottom. That could be separated. But if the problem is new or you have to invent something, that's probably better to have this less structured kind of networking approach.
There was an article, I don't remember who wrote it, but they were using the metaphor of a documentary film. And the reason why it resonated with me was because when they were talking about making a documentary film, you don't really know when you start making the film what is going to happen at the end. You have a pretty good idea, right, of a story that might be there. But until you interview whoever you're going to be interviewing, you can't predict if your original storyline is actually going to be the final story. Yeah, I really like that because it's like building product. You know, we have a hunch that if we build this feature, this is going to happen, but we don't really know. And so when they were talking about it in terms of how the film crew has to come together on a really low budget and people have to be multitaskers. So if you have a really, really small budget, you have to be able to be a cameraman and a sound person and the storyboards or whatever. And so it really, like, that whole model struck a chord with, and yeah, are they agile? Yeah, I think they have to be, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's like changing conditions also. I wonder if they have like a secret way of the way they do things, right? What is their secret process? What can we learn from documentary filmmakers about how they work and how they collaborate that we can bring into product development?
How about we set up a call like this with four people? We got Jerrica, who is a filmmaker, and she just recently finished a documentary.
Oh, she's working on it.
Yeah? They finished shooting, at least that's what I've seen. And then you can ask her. And I want to be at least a fly on the wall during this conversation.
No, come on, we are going to record that conversation.
Yeah.
It's going to be a bonus episode that's going to be fascinating.
Yeah, okay.
I would like to go back into more abstract question. When you were telling about yourself, you said that you swallowed the pill of Agile. Where does the difference lie for you?
When I was working in the interactive agency, it was kind of like a matrix thing. So I would ask for two engineers and one visual designer and one copywriter and maybe one UX person, one tester, which is the same as it is in an agile organization. But the part that was really completely broken for me was doing this fucking Gantt chart, sorry for the potty mouth, the Gantt chart thing where you had to plan it down to the hour, how long these tasks would take. Like that part just never worked for me because it never worked, right? We were already off schedule. And, you know,
on day one, right?
On day one, because I would spend days just, I was basically really good at Microsoft Project. And I was really good at moving bars around on Gantt charts and making it look okay. The other part was the whole thing about writing GUI docs before anyone would even start building anything. And I remember it was actually for the Citibank project because it was their first version of an online bank. And I remember, you know, 70 to 80 hour weeks writing GUI documentation saying where each button was going to go and exact line of copy before anyone technical would even know what it was that they were going to have to do. So I would spend weeks writing the GUI docs, and then we'd be sitting in day-long meetings, the agency on one side of the table and the people who are going to build it on the other side, going through each page of the GUI doc and reading through it, talking about it. And that was just months before you could see anything. And the other part, and maybe this was because of the trainers I had, maybe it was because of Mike Cohn and Ken Schwaber. They really hammered it home in that course about inspect and adapt. And that was new for me, the whole idea of inspect and adapt. And no, we don't have to keep doing the same broken thing over and over. But yeah, why don't we do it a little bit different this time? The whole idea of retrospectives, never did it when I was in Interactive. We just create the statement of work, execute, and then negotiate at the end over additional costs and additional time and then all of that. But we would never get the end of it saying, what happened here and how can we do it better? And we never did it. The whole inspect and adapt thing, right? Gone.
We have a suspicion why it resonated with you. Because this inspect and adapt is the thing that you did in the kitchen before, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Actually, ultimately, it was the customer. So my big sprint review would be seeing the plates that came back and if the food was still on them. And if the food was still on them, then something was wrong. Yeah, there was always inspect and adapt.
What lessons can you draw from your past?
The ethnomusicology thing taught me first and foremost about how to listen. It's super important, especially because you're dealing with people who aren't from your own culture. So you have to really try extra hard to understand what they need. And then here we go into the empathy thing, which is like one of my big favorite things. Yeah, you need to listen really carefully and you need to communicate really carefully too. Because what I was doing as an ethnomusicologist was producing these concerts. So you would have, you know, a West African kora player who would be on this Western stage performing, but we would have to organize a sound check and figure out where to put the microphones and understanding how he needed to sit, if he was in a chair or on the floor, making sure the lighting was working. You know, some of these artists had already been quite famous, like we did Ravi Shankar and Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan. And like, you know, they were used to Western stages, but other people weren't. And so you really had to be that intermediary between the technical world, the business world of front of house and the box office and the performer. That's the part where I really enjoyed it, was like connecting the dots and facilitating the communication. And in the kitchen, the stuff I learned the most about was teamwork and how to not let your team down. I learned it from a very difficult lesson where I was in one of the stations and I was trying to not fuck up, but I was slowly losing control over things, but not telling anyone. And then that night was a fucking disaster. It started with me and then everything after me was held up and late. And I didn't ask for help because I wanted to be able to do it myself. This is why I always push that so hard with the teams I work with now. It's like, ask for help, offer help. The whole cowboy coder thing, right? You can't have that in a kitchen. Won't work. Unless you're a one-person kitchen, then yeah, sure, you can do it. And this made me think of, sorry, I'm going to like throw another thing in. This made me think of this whole idea of checklists. And you were mentioning it before. There are things that are repeatable. We don't necessarily need all this bump around it. We should just do it because we know it's the right thing to do. And I've been looking for ways to get more of that kind of checklist mentality into things, just to free up cognitive space. Like, why do we have, every time we do a release, think about everything we need to do? Let's just make a release checklist, and then we have it, and we don't have to think about it. We could just follow it. And if we miss something and something goes wrong, then we can update the checklist and make sure it happens. It's like giving ourselves a safety net in a way.
There's actually two things in this, because this checklist could be also a ritual. And the best example I've heard of is a military fighter pilot. Once they are in the air, it's, you know, OODA loop. And it's like completely on reaction. But before they do, they go through the same freaking checklist thousands of times. So one part is to make sure that everything is fine. But another thing which is related to this is with the surgeons washing their hands. They come from one mode to another mode. And in one mode, you could do anything. In the other, you are highly organized. Everything is prescribed. So I'm just wondering if maybe your team needs a different mindset for the release mode, because that is more controlled. Maybe this could be combined, that there is this switch. So now we're like cowboy coders because we don't know any better. That's fine. But now we go through the phase and now we are in a different mode.
Yeah. And that makes me think of, have you read Atomic Habits yet by James Clear? So he talks about when you're trying to create good habits, you basically chain events that happen all the time that you don't think about because they're already automatic, and you use those as anchor points for the new habit that you want to create. For instance, it took me like half a year to set up this morning routine for myself. And I actually, today when I was writing stuff down because I'm trying to do some more new habits, I did my habit inventory. And basically between 5 o'clock in the morning and 6 o'clock in the morning, it's set. And now I'm trying to add this new habit in there. And so I cued the new habit to be right after the last repeatable thing. So basically it's after I write in my journal about my three gratitudes, I then open up this document that I'm working on and write for 20 minutes because I always write my three gratitudes if I don't even think about it. And now I'm adding this new thing because before I would go to Instagram and start surfing and go down the fucking rabbit hole before I had to get ready to work out. And now I'm saying, okay, I'm not going to do social media in the morning until I get the writing out of the way or I work on whatever. And when I was doing that today, I was thinking, how can I introduce that to my team? First of all, what habit do we want to adopt as a team? And let's think of ways that we can chain events together that always happen and just start doing that new habit. So what's the trigger for jumping into the checklist? There's a release happening actually next week. And I had to go in and say, hey, is anyone looking at the checklist that we made? Oh, yeah, the checklist. Yeah. You know, and they're doing it, but they didn't think about doing it automatically. So there's something there that I need to figure out how to help them connect that. Do you have any ideas?
No, but my mind is buzzing with questions around your habits. Do you mind if you explore it a little bit?
Okay.
So why have you created this morning habit list or a chain?
Because I wanted to get stuff done. It was basically that. It started all around losing weight like 3 years ago. So my morning habit then was pretty simple. It was just waking up early and going to work out. My KR was that I would work out 6 days out of seven a week. So to make sure that happened, I would say, okay, I'm going to wake up. I'm going to have a little bit of breakfast and then I'm going to work out and nothing in between. So then it grew into kind of personal development stuff. So for a while I was saying, okay, I'm going to wake up before I go work out. I'm going to meditate for 10 minutes. And the cue was after I drink my coffee, I'm going to put the coffee cup down and I'm going to turn on Headspace for 10 minutes and sit in my chair. So I chained that one in. And then it was when I was trying to create my course, it was before I go work out, I'm going to spend 20 minutes writing content for my course. It was basically just to get shit done because I'm better in the morning than I am at night.
So you are building a habit out of this just to make it easier.
Yeah.
Rather than consciously decide every morning again, what am I going to do?
Yeah. I don't have to decide. I know it's like so automatic now. I still have the alarm, but I'm up like at least 5 minutes before the alarm rings and I'm wide awake and I just do it. It's so routine. So I don't have to make the decision, am I going to work out today or not? Am I going to write today or not? I don't have to fight with myself. I just do it. Anyways, this book is like, he wrote about 1% improvement. You know, he's all about systems over goals. Mm-hmm. So it's all about create the systems where you can succeed and forget about the goal, because the systems are going to last you longer than the goal. Like, I lost the weight, but I'm still doing the system and I still feel good.
Can I dig a little bit more into your personal changes?
Sure.
I would like to go back into your decision to take a break, stop working at the agency and go into cooking. What did this break give you? How did it help you to figure out what's next?
So, first of all, it was completely out of my comfort zone. I was like, at least 15, if not 20 years older than most of the people in my cooking class, because they were all out of high school. And it was completely not intellectual or academic. It was very practical, manual stuff, which I've never felt like I was good at. So in a lot of ways, it was challenging myself to see if I could do something completely like, you know, I love cooking, but it was almost for friends and I just loved doing it. And like going into culinary school was a completely different ball of wax. And I didn't do well, you know, that's why I call myself a cook and not a chef, but I learned a lot and I'm glad I learned it. I learned a lot of practical skills. Why did I do it? I was really burned out in agency stuff. So again, this is project management before I took the agile pill. I was just really tired of it.
How was the process of going from the agency to the culinary school and then becoming a cook?
Yeah, I'll tell you one story. This is a great story, and I'm embarrassed to say it, but I'll tell you anyway. So when I was a project manager, I was a real bitch. I don't know if you've worked in advertising agencies, American advertising agencies, like you really have to be, I don't know, it's like this kind of culture of assholes, posturing, and I know I'm like totally making stereotype here, but I felt like in order to be respected at my work there, I had to be a bitch, basically. And I was quite a horrible person.
I can't imagine it.
Like I was mean. I know, people can't, but you know, Kelsey, my wife, like she used to call me at work and I would just be like, hello, it's Mel. What do you want? Kind of, I made people cry. Really awful stuff. Okay, so we have that, right? This is Mel's work mode, my work way of working. I wasn't like that when I was producing concerts, by the way, but I was in advertising. And then I went to cook school. And one of the things that we had to do as a final project was basically create a menu, and the rest of the people in the class were the kitchen staff, and we would have to serve the menu to real paying customers. There was like a restaurant attached to the school. So on the night that it was my night, I reverted back to my project management bitch mode. And it wasn't a great, I mean, I got all the food out and I was like totally high on adrenaline from it. Like it was like the scariest fucking thing I did was that night organizing the whole thing. And I had a debrief afterwards with my professor and he just fucking, you know, gave it to me straight. He's like, you were not a good leader. The way you talk to your classmates there is not the way you're going to get any good results out of people you work with. And he really just like cut me right down. And it stuck with me so long after that. Like, why did I behave? You know, I just kind of reverted back to this default behavior of ordering people around and being a bitch. And that lesson, like, that was another like big lesson from cook school. And I don't think I would have gotten that if I hadn't had that experience. The way I am now, the way Lukasz knows me now, was completely different. And he was right. Like, why be a nasty bitch and expect people to want to work with you and for you and do good results? And that's how I was.
So what is good leadership for you?
I'll start with the empathy thing, first of all. So I think to be a good leader, you have to have empathy for the people who you're leading. And you need to also provide good direction. You need to be able to make decisions that aren't always easy to make, but be transparent about them. So I think transparency is really important. You know, there's this whole part of being human. You need to be human. So it's like that emotional intelligence part. And I think the best leaders I had were like that. It's about creating an environment where people can succeed. I don't think everyone thinks about that. What do people need? What kind of environment do they need? What's their threshold for change? And what's their threshold for ambiguity? And how much transparency is maybe too much transparency? So I think there can be too much transparency. So I recognize that there's that bad end of the spectrum where a leader doesn't make any decisions and is acting from a place of fear and isn't withholding information to the team and doesn't want to be the bad guy and wants to be everybody's friends. Like, I don't think that's healthy either. So, you know, it's a spectrum and you need to find some place in the middle of that. And I think the part in the middle is where you can be human and show vulnerability and show when you don't know something. But when you do say you don't know something, like, still make it somehow safe. It's really hard. But I'm mentoring 3 tech leads right now where I work. And we're covering the basics. So we're mostly talking these days about them and understanding who it is they're leading, how to do a one-on-one, and what are the elements of a good one-on-one. And I've been telling them about delegation poker a lot. Like, I really want to play them to play it with their teams. We've been talking about how to make your expectations clear. Like, I think that's also really important when you expect something, how to make sure that that expectation has been clearly understood on the receiving end. Because I think it's easy to say, you know, I want this and do this, and then the person that you're directing or leading has no idea what you're talking about or has a completely different understanding, and then they do something and then it's not what you wanted. And why waste that time cycling? Like, make sure that you're understood. It's about talking less and listening more. I don't know, it's kind of weird. When I'm saying it to you guys, it sounds almost so obvious. Maybe it's not. I don't know.
So what you mentioned is one. But another axis is that suppose we are going to build something new, so we are not falling on structures. We really want this kind of emergent behavior. There is still a balance to be found, because this has to happen within some boundaries between how much you constrain activities, freedom in a way of, you know, what we do, and where you give space to the team and to the individuals to come up with their own stuff. That is another axis that needs to be balanced.
So this is tangential, but I think it's important to talk about all the different cognitive biases that we carry with us and having an awareness of them. And it's especially important for leaders to have that I've been slowly getting more into this, discovering this whole cognitive bias world. It's really fascinating. I think it goes back to this uncertainty about how we make decisions. So that's another, okay, another good thing that a leader does is teach the team how to make decisions and not just have a toolbox, because I love toolboxes, but there's not only one method for making decisions. Like, you should tailor your decision-making process to the problem you're trying to solve. And learning how to do that is important.
When you were talking about the good leadership, you mentioned vulnerability, which is something rather difficult for many leaders who are in higher positions. And when you were talking about it, I got this connection with your cooking experience and about asking for help. So how do you see this vulnerability, asking for help, and leadership?
So first, the vulnerability thing is about generating trust. By showing some vulnerability, you can get connection more easier with other people because you're more human. That's one thing I'm thinking of. And the asking for help, I'm not sure always if asking for help is necessarily a sign of vulnerability. I think probably a lot of people think it is, but okay, I'm going to bring it back to coaching. So people who want to up their game or really improve, they hire professionals who are skilled in whatever that area is to help them. And I don't think the movie star who's hiring a personal trainer is showing vulnerability by asking for help from a personal trainer. That movie stars realize that they can get to their result a whole lot faster if they ask someone who really knows about that thing that they need help with. The other kind of asking for help is something I learned really recently talking to some of the artificial intelligence guys at where I work. It comes from the land of academia. He was explaining that his whole thing was about attack the idea, not the person, and how it's super common and super important when you're in academia to get critical review of your ideas, because that critique will help you improve your idea. And you need that so that you're not going to publish some kind of nonsense that's going to be completely rejected. So you ask as many people as you can to review your work and to poke holes in it. And you want them to poke holes in it because you're going to inevitably miss something. And only by kind of putting your ego aside and kind of, it's not about me, it's about this artifact that I created, and please, can you help me make it better? Mm-hmm. When I was talking to him, you know, I was like introducing myself to him and his team. And I'm like, hi, you know, I'm Mel, the Agile coach, and I'm here to help you guys work better together if you want to. And he was kind of like, had to take me down a notch and explain, you know, our world is completely different than product development world. And we're used to failing. Success is very rare for us. So we're all about getting as many failures as we can. And we're very resilient to failure. And so the idea of continuous improvement somehow makes sense, but somehow doesn't in their world. That also makes me think of this other podcast I listened to with this surgeon who hired a coach and basically had the coach watch him in surgery so that he could improve and become a better surgeon. This guy's already like a rock star surgeon, but he has a coach now who was his previous mentor, who just watches what he does in the operating theater and debriefs after and says, this is what I saw and this is how you can get better. Is this guy vulnerable by asking for a coach? I don't think so. So I wouldn't put asking for help necessarily next to vulnerability, even though a lot of people would.
I see like a slight nuances there. So you are asking a professional. That's probably something else than if you ask your peer.
Yeah.
Maybe asking the first time is more difficult before this trust develops. Might not be a constant in time.
Yeah, definitely. And you have to learn how to respond to and ask for help also, right? So this happened to me yesterday. Someone asked me for help. And really what they were looking for is just a sounding board. At the end, they didn't really want any advice from me. They just wanted to be heard and listened to. But then I'm thinking of, you know, in the context of the everyday work, when is a good time to ask for help? You're looking on the board and someone's got this task in progress for 2 days. You're not quite sure what's going on. Why aren't they asking for help? People have sometimes difficulty offering help because this also happened on a team I had before. Like, they were really in the habit of saying, I just finished something. Does anyone need help on whatever they're working on? Like, we got that part, right? We cued that habit. But mostly people didn't take them up on the offer because they were already, like, you know, heads down in the middle of the code. Mm-hmm. And where's the threshold of maybe, yeah, you should just let that person work on their own and tinker with it some more and sort through the problem before throwing help on, right?
I have a feeling that somewhere in the solution to this, there are priorities. Mm. Because another thing that has to be taken care of, although it does happen very occasionally, is refusing help. Sometimes someone asks you for help and you basically have something more important to do, objectively or subjectively, and that somehow ties in there as well.
Yeah, definitely. But the worst thing that can happen when you ask for help is that the person says no, right?
It's just exactly as if you didn't ask, right?
Yeah, so you might as well ask because maybe they'll say yes.
What does it take to develop a person who can be a coach like you, a professional coach?
I think you need curiosity, first of all. I believe that my curiosity about people is what helps me be a good coach. That is just how I am. I'm curious about people and what makes them tick and where they're coming from and what their background is. There's the other part of just wanting to share knowledge. So there's maybe two or three parts to it, right? The part number one is the best way for me to learn is by teaching. So I have a selfish aspect to coaching, which is I want to learn more. And the second part is this kind of investment or pay it forward concept, where by teaching and by coaching, you're equipping people with the tools to continue, you know, well after they're in a completely different situation, they still have those tools. And I think that's basically it. Empathy, curiosity, desire to give and help.
Improv theater could be also a very interesting space.
I do improv theater when I do team kickoffs. So it's usually something no one's ever done before. A, it's physical. So it's not like mind stuff. It's very physical. And B, like I said, it's something that most people have never experienced. So it's completely out of your comfort zone. You don't know what to expect. You can't plan in advance. C, it's super fun. And D, there's a lot of parallels between what you do in the games and how you act outside of a game in real work situations when you're on a team. We basically build up these sequence of improv games until by the end, the team is like acting out a skit of a commercial for some fantastical product that doesn't exist. It's really fun. And what was really cool about the last couple ones I did is that well after the workshop, the team was kind of doing some of the games on their own anyway. Like, there's one called Pass the Clap, which is you're just standing in a circle with the team and you have to like look to the person next to you and clap simultaneously so there's no echo. And then you pass it, and then you can pass it in one direction or turn around and pass it in another direction, and you have to speed it up and go really fast. But what it does is it really makes you connect with the person next to you. You actually don't look at the hands because then it won't work. You have to look in the eyes and recognize when you're going to do it. And so it's like that kind of stuff. I love it. It's like so haptic.
in a way, we went to a topic of tools because you tell that you love tools and you love building toolboxes.
Yeah.
Could you tell something more about your favorite tools?
So for sure, all the improv games are really important to me. The NVC, nonviolent communication, is another tool. And I use that in various forms to teach people how to give feedback and receive feedback. Then all these different techniques for how we can be more explicit with each other about what we want. And so again, NVC ties into that, but things about what I'm going to do, what I'm not going to do, getting clear on our role definitions, separating the person from the role, all of that. What else? I don't know if I can call it a tool, but I'm always looking for ways to make it more human at work. And so whether it's simply making a point of going around the whole office when I arrive and shaking or saying we give each other kisses, but like saying hello to everyone instead of just schlumping in and sitting at my desk and starting to work, that kind of instilling human connection wherever I can. And then cultivating, infecting people with this curiosity. So I'm always sharing articles and tweets and things I've read, getting people to extend their horizon out and asking questions, I think is like a really simple tool, like how to ask powerful questions and how to listen is the ultimate, learning how to listen.
Like, what is the empowerment that the coach gives to people?
I think that the role of the coach in terms of empowering people is giving them the tools to learn on their own and improve. I have a story about it. When I was still doing performance and I had a viola teacher, it was towards the end of me working with her because we both knew I wasn't going to continue in the performance track. But she said, let's spend the next month just, I'm going to teach you how to take apart a piece of music and learn how to play it. Basically, what she taught me was how to learn, how to keep learning so that I wouldn't need her. Basically, provide me the framework for improving on my own. And I think that's the most valuable thing a coach can do. Teaching whoever, their client, how to think critically about what they're doing in the way that a coach would think. So they can start thinking about it more holistic way about what's going on instead of just blindly doing.
If you consider success coaching yourself out of the job, there are a few jobs like this. And from what you are describing now, it seems like it is also your kind of goal. Like, but I've met people with different approaches to their jobs as well.
So yes and no. I would say yes and no. I think that you can always find the next thing to improve. And maybe you'll get to the point where the team is going to run themselves and your kind of shelf life has expired in terms of how you can help them. But then within an organization, within the system, there's always another part of the system to go look at. If you're like a one-on-one coach, then yeah, maybe you would have kind of an expiration date. Or maybe not. It really depends on your relationship with your client and what they want to do and where they want to go.
Yeah, I can appreciate this, but I'm thinking about your vector of motivation, right?
Yes. Okay, I see what you're saying. But something about it doesn't sit right with me because it's not like you would throw all the information at them at once.
Yeah.
Because then that would make things worse. So it's knowing how to parcel it out and knowing the opportune moments for whatever lesson you're trying to give. I think the other really important thing a coach has to do is remind people of their progress, like where they came from and how they've improved and how they've changed. And the other thing, I think it's important for a coach to get their clients in the habit of taking action. So what is the thing I'm going to do different? What am I going to tell you about next time that I did differently from this time?
I hear you saying that what you give, it could be a very specific solution, but you'd rather give a method. So if someone asks, should I go left or right? One way would be, yeah, go left. end of story. And the other would be...
What do you imagine it would be like if you went left? What do you think it could be like if you went right? Yeah.
So very Socratic way of coaching.
Yeah, definitely. And I think also it varies, right? Sometimes people just want to be told what to do. And sometimes it's okay to do that. But most of the time, if someone just wants to be told what to do, then they're not really, they haven't given themselves the space to think about what it is they're trying to fix to begin with. And I was telling you about this one team where they feel like they are too slow. They want to go faster. And their solution is they want to split into two teams. So my role as a coach is to really unpack that and stay in the realm of why do we think that we're not going fast enough? And how do we unpack this? Let's draw a causal loop diagram about this. We're not going fast enough. How might it play out if we divide ourselves into two teams? Just the act of drawing that diagram together will get something probably a lot different than splitting into two teams.
There's one more thing that I wanted to ask you about. So you say that you write for yourself a gratitude journal.
Uh-huh.
Is there a practice that you use with the teams of a similar kind?
So I do it with teams, and I usually put it in retrospectives. One of the things I close retrospectives out with is flowers of appreciation. The way you execute it is that at the end of the retro, everyone writes on a post-it a flower and the name of the person they want to give the flower to, and then they actually give the flower to the person and say why they're giving the flower. Again, it's my attempt to bring humanity into it, but it's also to cultivate this kind of sense of appreciation of each other and what we contribute to the team. And it's a nice way to end a retro with appreciation. I also like doing more on the quarterly, yearly basis. Again, like the whole thing about just about appreciation and seeing where we've gone and seeing what we've been through. And I think it's important to do that because you only talk about like what happened in the last 2 weeks, and it's really hard to go back 6 months or a year and actually see all the progress that's been made.
And also we are much more attuned to thinking about the things that didn't work rather than those that worked. So it's easier to
definitely
look at the failures.
Mm-hmm. Here's an interesting thing that I don't do as much as I could. In a lot of retrospective formats, it's usually what went well and what didn't go well. And we kind of gloss over what went well because we want to go straight to the what didn't go well so we can figure out solutions to fix them. But actually, it would be interesting to just stay in what went well and again, do this causal loop thing. Like, why is that going well? Like, what's happening there that we feel like a team is working really well together? Like, let's get concrete examples and share it with each other about why we think we're working well together. So we can remember when it's not going so well that we are able to do it again. It's a reinforcing loop, basically. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that's why I do it for myself. If I am writing about something I'm grateful for, then it's setting the whole day in a spin towards positivity. I'll tell you one I wrote the other day. I think it was the first day back at work. I have a really shitty commute. It's an hour and a half. And the last part of the commute is a tram ride that usually takes 5-10 minutes. And the tram wasn't working, so I had to walk 20 minutes to work. Yeah, so another 20 minutes on my commute. But actually, the next day, my gratitude thing, I wrote, hey, I got an extra walk in the sunshine in a neighborhood I haven't wandered around in. How cool is that?
Yeah, it's the matter of reframing what happens with us or to us.
Yeah. When you said that, it made me think this whole idea of false positivity, like being too optimistic or too positive. Again, it's a balance thing, right? The gratitude part is also like extending your awareness of the whole picture of what's going on rather than the negative spin on it, but not always being, we say Pollyanna, like not kind of seeing the world through rose-colored glasses.
Dalai Lama calls it a realistic outlook. So you can be optimistic, but with this realistic outlook.
Yes, I like that. Exactly.
And it gives you the space to see the little improvements, like you said, with the walk, You know, being there in the sunshine, it was nice weather, first day of work. So, you know, you have some oxygen intake before you get into the office. But on the other hand, yeah, still the commute is not ideal. So you understand that was nice for once, but if it was to happen every single day, probably that would, like, you would need to change.
I would have to get a bike.
Yeah, exactly. You would have to change something there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so the real challenge, though, is so we've spent almost 2 hours talking about all these neat things, right? How to share all of that with my teams. Sometimes it's so difficult to know when is the right moment to share that. Is it always a retrospective? But there's all these opportunities all the time, every day, to like do that. So for me, like right now, I'm kind of relegating myself to my workshops. That's my space and I can do what I want, and writing, and then sitting with people at lunchtime and talking to them, and occasionally facilitating a retro, and just like the random conversations, and all of that adds up, I think, to giving as much as I can to them. But it's never like from 9 to 10, I'm going to coach this team. You can't do it like that. You can't segment what we do into time blocks.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, it sounds to me like something very context dependent. I'm not sure if this anecdote exists in English, but I use it in Polish quite often. Basically, it's a joke and it's happening at the construction site. And there is a worker running like crazy with a wheelbarrow. And someone stops him and looks into a wheelbarrow and he says, "Yeah, you're running so fast, but this wheelbarrow is empty. Why?" And the worker says, "Man, we are in such a rush, we have no time to fill them up." Right? There is a lot of this stuff going on every day.
Mm-hmm. Slow down to speed up.
Yeah.
And I think that with the culture that we've got today with majority of organizations is that we have to be fast, we have to deliver, we have to push towards the deadline. And when we rush, we are not activating the prefrontal cortex. We are basically running on our instincts. So we keep on doing the same things over and over and over again. So there's no space to actually change any habit if you are rushing. You can only do it when you slow down.
Yeah.
Yeah, speaking about this, Mel, you said that part of your morning routine is writing stuff for a course. Is this the internal course in your company, or there is something public that we can all take part in?
Yeah, so it was for a course that I published already. So the course is done. Well, the habit this year is doing all the marketing around the course so people actually know it exists.
Let us help you. Tell us a few words about this course. Where do we find it? What is it about?
So,
for whom?
Okay, the course is, it's basically for people who are Scrum Masters or coaches who are on their own. So they're probably working in a company and they're the only agile person there. And they're expected to fix all the problems and take care of all the teams, but they don't have the benefit of center practice or anyone to bounce ideas off of. And they don't have a lot of time. So that's the target audience. And the course is called Agile Anti-Patterns. I basically take each of the ceremonies. So I take the stand-up, the planning, the review, and the retrospective ceremonies. And I talk about common anti-patterns that I've seen. And then some possible tools for my toolbox of how to fix those anti-patterns. So each anti-pattern has a video. Like for the stand-up, I think I have 5 different videos, 1 video for each anti-pattern. After each ceremony, you have homework. So there's like 5-minute homework you can do, or homework that will take you maybe half an hour, and then homework that will take you maybe an hour, half a day to do. And you submit the homework. And then after each course, you get like an hour one-on-one coaching with me. And we talk about your homework and what problems you're facing, and then off you go.
This is cool. Where do we find this course?
Well, so I'm shy to tell you because the landing page is shit right now. This is the thing I'm learning learning how to like market the whole thing. But it's agilista1.teachable.com. And that's where
all right,
you can
we'll
find
put it. In writing in the show notes.
Creating an online course was like me going to cook school. I had no idea. I still obviously don't because I don't know how to market it. This is what I'm going to learn how to do is, you know, how to build an email list and blah, blah, blah. But creating that course was really, I've been talking about this course for maybe 3 years. Then after I was working in Warsaw, I decided, okay, I'm really going to do it. I'm going to do this course. And so I got someone to help me. I asked for help. And I had a coach who was acting as a coach, but more as an accountability partner, mm-hmm. who I worked with for about 3 or 4 months to get going on the course. And he like really helped me a lot. But I procrastinated so much on it. I just like, I could not get myself to do it. And in fact, what happened was by February last year, I had done all the videos. So I had shot like maybe 25, 30 videos. And then I did nothing until August this year. No, September this year, where I finally went back to the videos and edited them and put titles in. And then I waited another couple of months until I was at Agile by Example, actually published the course on Teachable. And like put the whole structure there and put the homeworks in. And now it's sitting there doing nothing because I haven't marketed it. And why am I telling you this? And oftentimes when we think of someone as lazy or like that person is lazy or they're just a procrastinator, it's coming from a place of fear. Because it's not that I didn't want to do it. Every day I was beating myself up about, you got to do the fucking course, Mel. Like, why aren't you like already selling it? Or why is it not done? And it was because I was just like completely scared of putting it out there and not knowing what to do. And I'm exactly at that point now with the market. I have no idea. I just picked a course last week. I said, okay, I'm going to do this 4-video course on how to market your course. It's a course on how to market your course. I'm going to do it. And then I'm going to do the exercises. And then the next thing I'm going to do is find a book about it, read the book. And I'm going to keep doing it until I feel like I have mastered marketing the course. But the reason why I'm saying it is that we often forget that we don't procrastinate because we're lazy. We mostly procrastinate because we're scared. And we don't know where to start or we don't want to fail. Like that was a big thing for me. Like it took me ages to get over imposter syndrome. Like who the fuck am I to like do a course about agile anti-patterns when there's Mike Cohn doing videos, you know, why should I do my videos? And it took me ages to get over that. Yeah. Now I have the course and now I have to market it.
You want to say something, Aga, about this? We've been discussing this a lot.
Yeah.
And we have been both through that, what you are just describing.
We should do a thing about it. I mean, we say it to teams all the time, right? Just ship it. Ship it and get the feedback and then iterate from there. I know, so why haven't I?
If there was a book that you think of recommending our listeners, what would it be?
Nonviolent Communication, A Language of Life by Marshall Rosenberg. Because nonviolent communication is one of the most powerful tools or creating shared understanding.
If you were to think about your life motto, what would it be?
Stay curious.
Mel, thank you for this conversation. It was fantastic.
Thank you too. I had such a great time.
Thank you very much, Mel. All the best. Hope to see you soon.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Catching the Next Wave podcast. We would love to hear from you on Twitter at Malka6 and at DLS6. You can find more details on www.catchingthenextwavepodcast.com.
Slow down to speed up.